Welcome back to Limitless Lives. I'm your host, Nilesh Patel. Today, I am thrilled to have Mathian with us, a visionary singer-songwriter and producer whose craft defies genre boundaries, blending 70s funk, alternative hip-hop, jazz and R&B into soul-touching anthems. Mathian's musical roots trace back to Chicago suburbs in the US, and his journey has been nothing short of remarkable. From igniting MySpace with his earlier work to capturing hearts worldwide, his music resonates with a raw, introspective honesty. In 2023 alone, Mathian's tracks reached over 2.2 million streams on Spotify, engaging 870,000 listeners across 182 countries, proving that his sound not only connects, but deeply moves with his audience. With nearly 20 full-length albums, international collaborations, and a steadfast drive to remain genuine in an industry that often demands conformity, Mathian's story is a masterclass in passion, authenticity, and the unyielding power of music. So get ready to dive into the world of an artist who embodies the spirit of passion, resilience, and creativity. Let's welcome Mathian and uncover the essence of his limitless life in music. Mathian, welcome to the show. I'm really grateful to have you here today.
Nilesh, that has to be the greatest intro I've ever heard.
Thank you. It's your story. I'm just sharing it with the world. So thank you once again for being here.
May I have that and just copy and paste it into my Spotify biography there?
Absolutely. Tell you what, if you make that track one on your next album, we've got a deal.
I'll put some symphony music behind it.
Well, awesome. Thanks for being here, like I said, once again.
Thank you.
I'd really want to reflect on the beginnings of your journey. It started off in the suburbs of Chicago. How did your earlier life and initial inspirations shape the foundation for your music career?
Well, I guess I was just one of those people who was drawn to sound, drawn to music, figuring out how things work. I grew up in a very supportive household. My parents, they were always trying to get us to do new things. By the time I received my first guitar when I was like 8, I don't think they had a lot of faith that I was going to stick with it. And then when they saw that I stuck with it, they were just amazingly supportive. But I started taking piano lessons when I was like 5, and I wasn't really looking at the book, and I wasn't performing up to the teacher's standards, I guess, but I was playing the piano all the time and trying to figure out the songs that were playing on the radio. I have this memory of seeing mariachis at a Mexican restaurant, and they were going to each table, and they came to our table, so it was the first time I saw like a guitar really up close, and that's sort of when my parents were like, okay, he looks like he's interested. And then beyond this, beyond actually playing instruments, is always fiddling with like tape recorders and stuff like that. So, you know, speeding up my voice. And at some point, my dad, I was probably 7th or 8th grade, he brought home software from his office because these guys were like computer nerds. He worked at he's a database administrator. So he was with all these like really like techie people. And someone gave him an illegal cracked version of a software called Acid. And I always joke that my dad brought Acid home to me. But it was the first time I was able to multi-track record something. So, and this is, I was pretty young. And once I figured this out, I stopped playing like video games because I was like so obsessed with this. And I recorded the first Mathian songs probably by the time I was like 15. Wow. And this is after, I mean, I'd already had guitar lessons and I had already a musical journey prior to all that. It definitely did start young.
That's incredible. You started developing these skills at such a young age. I'm curious, what kind of music was commonly played in the household during that time?
Oh, yeah. Well, my mom was into like soft rock, and she still is. She likes, her favorite of all time is James Taylor. And my dad is like sort of on the other end of the spectrum. He was a metalhead. So he was playing me Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath and Pink Floyd, stuff like that. I liked both of it, you know, and I think you can hear that in the Mathian music. You can hear sort of the trippy kind of stuff that my dad was into. And then you can hear the pop sensibilities of 70s soft pop or soft rock, whatever you call it. I got really into all kinds of music when Napster came out. Yeah.
That takes me back. You're aging me a little bit.
I'm aging me.
So you learn about all these technologies, which is fascinating, and some of the musical influences at home. What do you feel was the starting point for you to go on this journey? It wasn't just learning the piano and the guitar. How were your parents involved in some of this, or how did they support you at the beginning?
Well, my Aunt Margie, she had an old classical guitar in her closet in the basement of their house. And I would, during family parties, I would run down there and just take it out and play it. And so they ended up giving me that guitar. And they said, if you play this guitar for a year, we'll get you an electric guitar. Because that's all I wanted to do was to, you know, go full Eddie Van Halen. Well, at the time, I was really into Green Day, but like early Green Day. And yeah, so I wanted to rock. And I don't think they thought I could do it. I think they thought I was going to move on to something else. And then a year went by so fast. And I got pretty good after a year, too. And then my Uncle Matt gave me my first electric guitar. And I still feel bad about it to this day because he gave me this electric guitar. And I guess it was more of a borrow. And I don't know if I really understand like people's things back then. I was probably, you know, 9 or 10, maybe a little older. And I drew all over this guitar with a Sharpie, wrote all kinds of things on it, made like an art piece out of it, put stickers on it. And then he called one day and asked for it back. Like, and we gave it to him. We put it in the case and I'm sure he opened it up and was like, what the hell happened here?
That's amazing. You mentioned you proved your family members wrong, that this was more than just a short-term hobby. Where did you end up taking that from childhood into your teens and into early adult life?
Well, okay. So they put me in guitar lessons at a place called Beautiful Music in South Wheaton, Illinois, Donata Square. And I was taught by this guy named George Bellis. You can still look him up today. He's still active and he's a shredder. He's like one of the fastest guitar players. He's one of those guys that you'll see would pop up on your Instagram just going absurdly fast. And he was so knowledgeable. And I would bring in a cassette tape of songs I liked from the radio. And he could sit there and just listen to a song and then play it back on the guitar. And watching him do that taught me how to do it. So then I figured out how to, I was born with a certain amount of like ability to hear something and be able to figure it out. But watching him do it just sharpened that skill. So, and then my parents put me through music school. I went to music school at Southern Illinois University. That's kind of where it started progressing into my teens and early adulthood, I guess. All this time I was starting bands and everything too, or joining bands. And it wasn't until I got down to college where I was still recording all my Mathian songs and passing them out on CDRs. And eventually these musicians who were in the music department heard it, and the first version of the Mathian like live band setup was totally initiated by someone else. They were like, hey, we should do this. And I was like, oh, okay.
It sounds like your family were really supportive of your ambitions and dreams and interests, and more importantly, your passion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially from an early age, to understand what your passion is and to have the support to pursue that. That's something remarkable.
Yeah. It really is. These people who go their whole lives not really understanding what they wanted to do. You know, I talk to people all the time that say that, like, oh, I wish I knew what my passion is. And I was like, wow, yeah, I wonder what it's like to not have a passion.
What drove you to music, or what do you think fueled the passion, and what do you think the catalyst was for that?
Well, when I first heard music, it scared me. My mom brought home a tape or something from someone, made her a tape, I think. If I remember correctly, it was like chamber music, symphonic and maybe some choirs and stuff like that, kind of like intense classical music, which was, I think someone was like, this is what I listen to, so take this home and listen to it. So my mom would probably not choose to listen to that, but it made me cry. Whatever piece of music she put on made me cry. So I think the emotional attachment we have to these sounds is what drove me to it.
I really appreciate music for the ability that it has to take you back to any moment in time. And
yeah,
just that, but it also brings about that feeling that you felt in that specific moment. And I don't think there's anything else that can do that as powerfully as music does.
Yeah, truly. Like I don't keep a journal because I have all of these like little flags in my head of things that happen. And I can just go off of like, first of all, my songs that I write, but any song that I've ever fallen in love with, or even some songs hurt when you hear them. That's so cool. Yeah, you don't need to write things down.
Yeah, it's a form of expression too. I think some people may use it as a form of therapy, or just articulating how they feel, or just letting out what they've been suppressing inside. So yeah, there's many different ways of helping and making the world a better place. So thank you for bringing that gift to us. It's incredible. So speaking of fun, you've been on quite the journey, nearly 20 full-length albums. I'm pretty sure over that period of time, you've had to change, adapt, think about things differently. Can you discuss a moment when you first recognized the need to embrace change in your career or your direction and how you went about doing so?
Well, I was signed to a record label, which from that moment I had to change. But the real change happened after I got out of the deal. So it was 4.5 years, maybe 5 years of being in this situation that I didn't feel was favorable to me and my music. And yeah, that's like a whole side story probably. But the point is, by the end of it, I had just made some really like dumb life decisions, business decisions. Everything that I was doing was what I didn't need to be doing. I had a horrible drug experience during this time too, which that changed my life. After that, I didn't feel the same for a couple years. I had to really get back on track. But yeah, I broke up with my girlfriend. I got out of my management contract. I left with the record label, moved in with my parents, and then my parents ended up moving to Knoxville, Tennessee. And then so I felt like, well, since my life isn't where I want it to be, I'm just going to move down to Tennessee with them and start over. And that was a great place to do that because I didn't know anybody. It was a smaller town, Knoxville, and it was a little quieter and safer. And I was able to just get my bearings and figure it out.
It sounds like that was a good opportunity for you to just get some stillness in and amongst all this chaos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Getting out of the deal helped me realize that I did have autonomy and control over my career and over what the music sounds like. It made me really happy to be able to get back to, I felt like I lost who I was for those 5 years. And some of it was my fault and some of it, you know, I point the finger at the record label or whatever. But now when I look back at it, it was all things that needed to happen for me to be the person I am today, the fully realized Mathian.
What a beautiful one it is.
Nilesh, thank you. You're too kind, Nilesh.
That's track two for you. That's track two. That must have been a daunting phase of your life, not just from a personal perspective, but also you talked earlier about your passion, which was music. Mm-hmm. Given that you've gone through that, what's your perspective on not just surviving, but thriving during those periods of transition?
You got me with a zinger. Well, I guess I started thriving when I was true to my spirit, my heart. And yeah, everything started to kind of fall in place. And I always tell people I don't have goals. I'm not goal-oriented because all of my accomplishments in my life were sort of the result of whatever chance happening was occurring in front of me at the time and what I did with those occurrences. And for a while, people think you're aimless. But after a couple of years, you start figuring out the tightrope walk that it is, and things start to become really cool.
You just said that sometimes it feels like it's aimless. But there's beauty in that, right? Because you mentioned you don't really have goals and so forth.
Yeah.
Sometimes it is healthy to have goals and shape towards those. But I think when we become too fixated on the goal, we become too fixated on the outcome.
Goal culture is out of control in America. Goal culture, we're going to call it.
Goal culture. Yes, there we go. And it can inhibit creativity, right?
Yes, it definitely can.
And also the ability to remain present in that moment, to think about truly where you want to take yourself. So I'd love to hear more about that from your perspective of music and getting through that part of your journey.
Yeah, it's like you're saying, it lends itself to creativity because being creative and creating music is about, you know, be here now, Ram Da. The moment is crucial, but the minute you realize how crucial it is, then it also goes away too. You're trying to make something and you're overthinking, or even I think when you think you have something good and you get really, really excited about it, that can be dangerous too, because then you listen back a few days later and you're like, oh, it's not really hot. It's not really as good as I thought it was. And then the other thing happens where you make a sketch out an idea and then you don't listen to it again for another 2 months because you didn't really like it. But then 2 months later, when you listen back to it, you think, oh, that was really good, actually. Maybe I was having a weird day, or, you know, I was in a gloomy mood that day or something. That's why I didn't think it was good. But really, you know, I came up with this gloomy song.
It goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Music has that power to make you feel what you're feeling in that specific moment.
And, yes.
And that comes out. I mean, there's no right or wrong about that. It's just how that felt in that moment. You mentioned something really interesting earlier around how when you got out of the contract, it liberated you. The music industry can often exert pressures on artists to conform. Mm-hmm. How have you managed to stay true to your artistic vision outside of these pressures?
Part of it is understanding who to collaborate with, but another part of it is like doing a lot, you know, doing the artwork, doing the sound engineering on the records, playing on the records, and then making sure that if there's any outside help that you very much trust those individuals, whether it's someone playing on your record or someone helping to promote it, distribute it. I've figured out after a few years how to do that. I think after the label situation happened with me, when I started fresh, I had to go full like Prince, Trent Reznor with it and just do everything myself just to regain control. And then over the years, the collaborations have been happening more, both with business and with like the music part of it. It's like kind of like a hurt dog, you know?
How did you pick yourself back up?
I think music saved me. Musically really saved me. Just having that as my landing pad. It's a pretty damn good landing pad if it's the thing that you love about life and it's your passion. It was a difficult, challenging time in my life, but it wasn't that bad because of the music.
And with the music, you talked about the emotions you pumped into it and it saved you. That's powerful.
Yeah, I felt a little silly after I said that. Music saved me. Some of these cliche things that you hear are real things. And it sounds almost corny, but music did save me.
It's a testament. Your passion is the thing that helped fuel you and helped you keep moving forward.
Definitely.
How do you maintain or continue to pour genuine emotion into your work, especially after nearly 20 full-length albums?
I think there's emotions running through people constantly, no matter what you're doing. And, you know, music and making music is about accessing. And so it's about accessing and being sincere to the emotions you're feeling. And it's a non-thought. It's a very tricky thing because you can't consciously sit down and do this pragmatic thing where there's a beginning, middle, and an end. You really just have to let everything go and forget, that's a tough one.
How do you do that?
I think it's playing, you know, it's like being in your room as a child again in your toy box, because you weren't thinking about making the greatest thing. Maybe you were, though. Maybe you were thinking about, I'm going to make the greatest like Lego tower or whatever. But anyways, the way I do it is I just tinker around and I play and I, you know, let's go back here to this drawer and pull out this old tape machine and record my guitars through this tape machine and then bounce the tape onto my music recording software and then take that sound and add an echo to it. And now, you know, whatever that ends up being, you know, at some point something will click and I'll be like, oh, this is an idea. This is a song. And I will almost, in some cases, I can almost feel the fully realized song in those moments and be like, okay, we got something. It's like, maybe it's like fishing, like catching a fish. When you start feeling it nibble, you're like, oh, okay. Start really getting it.
It's beautiful. You talked about you pull out the drawer, pull out a few things and see what you can create with it. And
yeah.
Isn't that what life's about? Creation, right?
I mean, maybe. I think it is, yeah.
Music is a form of that, but the creation aspect and what comes of that and then the feelings that they transpire. You said something really incredible and you only touched on it lightly, but it was so powerful, was the ability to play.
Yeah.
I think we forget about that in today's world. Just being playful, releasing our inner child has so much power, especially in a world where there's so much external influence around, well, you should do this, you need to look like me, or you need to be like me, or you need to feel like me.
Sounds like you're talking about goal culture.
Yeah, that thing called goal culture, yeah. So it's just fascinating, the inner play and just allowing yourself to be in a moment without any restrictions. It really does help with creativity and collaboration. It's fascinating that you have these outlets to help you do that. You also talked about when you were in this musical contract, you got out of that and maybe there were some doubts. What practices have helped you overcome self-doubt and still remain true to your passion for music?
I don't want to be cocky and say I don't have a lot of self-doubt, but I think I didn't really even consider any other. I definitely
like got some side jobs just to make money and stuff like that. But I didn't think like, oh, because I put this apron on that it's over for me. I did. Okay. That's maybe not all the way true. I did have a moment where, you know, this is after I like was with the label and I put out some records and we sold out the House of Blues. We toured all over the States. And then when I had to get a job at Starbucks, I did have a moment where I was looking in the mirror in the bathroom and I was kind of like, man, this sucks. And then, you know, people I went to high school with were coming through the drive-through and they're like, what are you doing here? You're talented. And so that was like, that sort of hurt and it stung. But maybe those moments also themselves to becoming better and striving for more because, you know, I didn't like it.
What did you do with that?
It was a good thing for me to do, to have a job like that, because I needed to be humbled. I really had a, you know, I can say, oh, boo-hoo, poor me about my little label situation back then. But I was really full of myself and, you know, not my best self during those times either. So to have this job where I'm in a little window there getting people their coffee and then people who used to know me from high school are coming through and they're kind of confused. And also just the communal aspect of being in a workplace. It was good for me. Just being in a normal atmosphere. It's not all about me. Yeah, it really helped me.
Who was around you during that period of time to potentially support you and help you? What sort of support mechanisms did you have in place to help you, if any?
Well, there was this, by the time I started working at, I transferred to the Starbucks in Knoxville, Tennessee. I worked with this really great guy named Joey English and countless other people who were just really cool. My boss, Brad, was cool. My other boss, Leanne. Yeah, there's this folk singer guy, Joey English. And eventually they started scheduling us opposite each other because we were having too much fun. It was ridiculous, you know, like a couple of like 30-year-olds just acting like high schoolers, basically goofing around on the, you know, doing like weird stuff when the customers would pull up saying bizarre things. He used to have this thing where he would pretend like he was doing math. So he would go, hey, welcome to Starbucks. What can we get for you? And I'd be like, oh, chai tea latte and a muffin. Okay, so that's going to be, and then he would go, 363, carry the 2. He would act like he's doing a math problem. I was like, this guy is hilarious. So we were having so much fun. Yeah, but I'd never really had those moments where whenever I felt down, I kind of knew what to do. Not to be cocky or anything, but.
What did you do?
I just knew that the feeling was going to go away and that I'd be okay afterwards. So you just got to be in it when you feel down. You got to be in it. Be one with it instead of, you know, realizing you're not going to feel this way forever is important. But also, you know, just be in your feelings. If you're sad, just be real sad. Just be real sad about it. And if that means go downstairs at the piano, write a song, then do that. But for me, it usually means like sleeping and watching like some weird old movie or something. That's how I get over things.
You've talked about some of the strategies around how you've managed through the highs and the lows. I'm curious how you stay emotionally and creatively aligned to your actual music.
My wife really helps me with this because you could get obsessive and go into your studio every day. But it's important to do some physical activity. We do the little CrossFit gym in our neighborhood now. We go on walks. We go hiking. I sometimes work out at home, but just doing something strenuous like that, like running. We ran a mile the other day. I just remember afterwards, I was so winded. My heart was beating. And it just wipes the slate clean so that maybe you can enter into a creative situation and have it be super worthwhile. And yeah, when you do that, when you do those like resets, you can really, I think maybe access the thing we were talking about earlier, you know, how inspiration is about, it's like a non-thought. It's a thing that happens when you're not thinking, and there's no better way to not think than to push your body to the point of passing out.
Yeah. And it's fascinating you say that, right? Inspiration, tap back into it. Those feelings or creativity, inspiration, passion, joy, it's already there in the first place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all the external influences sometimes navigate us down a different path. But when you take a moment to reset, as you mentioned, it's quite easy to tap back into that. It's interesting that these are techniques and things that you leverage on a day-to-day basis to get you there. And let's not forget, your wife clearly is playing an important role in this too.
Like, oh yeah, she's the one who's like, you gotta get out of the house,
man. Yeah, and come back when you've reset. So what would you say through your journey have been the most valuable lessons you've learned about yourself, both as an artist and as a person?
When I was in music school, I was in music business school, they took us to the ASCAP building in Nashville. And for people who don't know what ASCAP is, they're a performance rights organization. They get artists money. So if your song ends up on the radio, if people play your song live, if they play your song at Walmart over the loudspeaker there, you're supposed to get money. And ASCAP is monitoring all of these places so that they can get you your money. So I'm in the ASCAP building. I really wish I could remember this guy's name. He was a classic older, he was probably in his 70s, 80s. And he was the Western guy, had the Western wear like cowboy shirt on with like the beads and stuff. And then he had the bolo tie. He had the big belt buckle, that huge belt buckle with the tight jeans. You've seen him probably walking around Houston. And he wrote the theme song to Smokey and the Bandit, this 70s show, I think.
No way.
Yeah, he had written the theme song to it, and it made him rich. And I asked him if you have one piece of advice for a musician nowadays, what would the advice be? And he said, every song you write is a lottery ticket. And, you know, the inner capitalist in me was like, oh, yeah, baby. So if I write, if I write 20 songs a day, that's like buying 20 lottery tickets. So it really made me want to really focus on songwriting, writing as many songs as I could and flexing that muscle. And that has really helped access these inspirational points for me, because it's like, man, I do this every single day. If you ask me to write a song about something, you give me a topic, I could do it in 5-10 minutes. Is it going to be amazing? No, I don't know. But I do it so often and I do it so frequently that I'm just always sort of able to access, I think. It's like bodybuilding, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's all he did was he sat in that gym.
That's incredible. I mean, that many songs you can push out. What is your creative process for that? Are you locking yourself in a room, or is it just when it comes, you're writing it down? How do you get through that?
I'm just experimenting. Thinking of new ideas, working on songs, but I'm pretty regimented. When I was young and starting off, I had this breakdown in front of my family because I was really poor and how am I ever going to make money? And I think my mom, or maybe my sister Tara, my brother's wife, I think they told me, you need to treat this like a 9-to-5. If this is your job, then you got to get up and go to your job. Then I said something like, but music is about your heart. And she said, your heart is not going to pay the bills.
And how did you react to that?
I love a good, like, tough love, quick little one-liner like that. Yeah, it made me feel awesome, honestly. I love when people put the fire under you.
You're integrating your job with your passion, and that's a beautiful place to be. And every song you write is a lottery ticket.
Yeah, that really appealed to the demon capitalist inside me. I was like, yeah!
It brings on an interesting question for me to ask you. How have those moments of recognition and success affected you, and how do you stay grounded?
Well, the love is in the music itself, because I for years wanted to be famous, and for years wanted to be rich from music. And, you know, there's been a couple times where I've made a nice like chunk of money from something that I did. And it was like, oh, this didn't alter things really. It made my life cooler for a few months. I think money's weird. I realized with those little victories I had, it's like, oh, this is not doing what I thought it was going to do. I'm not getting the spiritual reward that I thought that something like this would bring me. Coming to those realizations that this is not the purpose. It's not to gain some sort of number or something. Even outside of money, even looking at like streams and stuff like that, I always was obsessing about streams. How many streams? How many people listen to me today? And I was checking it all the time. And then I think I hit a dead end where I was like, this isn't fulfilling. And on this very small scale of fame that I've experienced, which is not really famous at all. But for instance, in my college town, I got famous in that little town. And I'm really happy it happened to me on a super small scale, because I was a douchebag about it. And I can't imagine if at that young, if I would have been Ed Sheeran level famous, I would have handled it the way I handled the little 300 people showing up to my gig. It would have been it could have been a recipe for disaster, no less.
You've had support from the very beginning from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the stories around when you had doubts, when you were feeling at your low, there were still people around you supporting you. You've been through that. And now I think about maybe other artists that are going through that, and not just artists, people just going through day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel is important for people to understand so that they can thrive?
Yeah. Ooh, that's another zinger, Nilesh. Got me again. I feel like I'm just going to repeat something from earlier. Just being true to oneself.
How do we do that? We say that, be true to yourself. What does that look like to you?
Anytime I was doing something that wasn't true to myself, I have like an emotional reaction to it. Like my heart hurts, my chest feels tense. If I do something that's out of character, or if I go against like my morals, it's always just been bad news. And so that was growing up for me, is getting into, okay, so if I don't want to experience these negative emotions, I can alter the way I react to situations, and I can alter, more importantly, the things that I do, the things that I initiate. Does that make sense?
It's between what you're feeling and response, there's a little space that you truly can own in terms of how you react to a given situation. And it sounds like that's for you, how you stay true to yourself. It's almost like a check yourself moment.
Yeah, I think that's been the spirituality for me, has been learning that, oh, you know, you do bad things, you're going to feel bad. If you do good things, you're going to feel good. So you should do good things.
You've just released your latest album. It's been quite the journey for you. What's been some of the key takeaways or things that you've learned from this album that you may have not have recognized about yourself from previous efforts?
Well, the song Still, I wrote it, was the first song that I wrote in my new home in Atlanta. And we looked at a bunch of different homes until we found this house. We looked at this house and I was like, we need to get this house. This house is beautiful. The guy who was selling the house wanted to give the house to the person who he felt fit the best. It was interesting. So he wasn't interested in getting, he really actually didn't want an investor. He was worried an investor was going to come and buy the house and try to like make money off of it. So we got into like a bidding war. And our realtor told this guy, hey, this couple, they just moved to Atlanta. They're living in an Airbnb in Marietta and they really want the house. And he ended up awarding the house to us. I don't know what the other bids were, but there were six other people who wanted the house, and he vetted us this way. So I felt like he was really just looking for a person to fill the space that he thought were maybe good people and sincere, and they had, you know, good intentions. And I thought that was really interesting to make such a decision like that based on emotions. And so when we closed on the house and I met this guy, I was like, man, this guy's really cool. He's a sort of an older dude. And he was like, what do you do for a living? I was like, I make music. He's like, are you going to build a studio in the house? I said, yeah. Well, he said, well, send me whatever you record. I want to hear it. And I said, oh, no problem. So we actually exchanged info. And then I started making music in here. You know, I bought a piano and I set everything up. And this first track that I started making was this very, I was just thinking about the new space I was in when I was creating the music. And a few months went by and I finally had enough songs together. I was like, I'm going to send that guy some of the stuff I've been making. And at that time, it was just like sketches. So yeah, I saw a neighbor and I was like, hey, have you talked to TJ lately? I just brought him up and the neighbor said he passed away. Uh-huh. So, and I did know that he was sick. They said that he was ill, and that's kind of why I think they were getting rid of the house. I think when I found that, I was like, oh, that didn't seem like when I met him, it didn't seem like somebody who didn't have a lot of time left. Mm-hmm. That's how that works, you know? You're always like, wow, really? But then that experience of finding out that news and me not being able to play him this music and him giving us this wonderful gift, this house, this new home, that went into the lyric writing. I was midway through the lyrics when this happened. So I was thinking about my own mortality, which is a lot to wrestle with for anybody, you know, thinking about the people you love going away, thinking about you going away yourself, transitioning over to whatever happens after we pass away. It's heavy stuff. To be able to approach something that heavy with peace is kind of a nice thing to fall back on. And that's what Still that's what still is for me. Still's essentially about that. It's about death. But, you know, there's cultures that celebrate when people die. And then there's other cultures who, you know, they make it this sad thing.
Yeah.
But, and then it's all those things. It is sad, and it is, you can look back, you know, you can look back on things and smile too.
Being still is a good representation for life. We talked about it earlier when you said sometimes it's important to just hit the reset button and go back to creativity, joy, freedom, love, and all these things. It's already there. It's in mm-hmm. the stillness.
Yes.
And we forget that. I'm not going to lie. Still for me is a banging track. I loved it. I've played that song so many times. And every time I hear it, I hear a different story. And
yeah.
I'm so honored to understand the actual background behind that story, because now some of that actually makes a lot more sense.
I want to try and perform it live at some point, but I get choked up. I get choked up when I talk about it.
Yeah.
When I play the recording, I straight up cry sometimes just listening to it.
It's a powerful song. There was one lyric in there, I've been torn since I've been born.
Yeah.
I'm still smiling today because I'm standing still. And I, mm-hmm. wow, that was powerful stuff. And the song itself, the way you put that together, it brings about many different emotions. It's an incredible song.
Yeah, we're all these flawed individuals, but in spite of all of that, there's still so much goodness and reasons to be happy.
Absolutely is. For artists starting out or people facing their own transitions in life,
yeah.
What advice can you offer about managing the ups and downs and staying true to one's path and passion?
One thing I like to do is when I get into those situations where I'm scared, where it's like, oh man, I need to figure out how to make some money, or if I'm stressing out about that kind of stuff, I get into those stressful situations. I try to work my way out of it. Okay, I'm going to wake up earlier tomorrow. I'm going to stay up late. I'm going to work all day tomorrow. And it helps, you know, immersing yourself in your work and in your craft and honing that. It helps generate things, maybe opportunities. But another thing I've learned is, so you can prevent these things from even happening, you should work that hard during your successes. So if you get a nice little paycheck from somebody and you make something really cool happen for yourself, yeah, you should definitely take yourself out to dinner and buy a nice outfit as a reward. But maybe you should do what you would do if you were panicking.
Yeah.
And work your way out of it. You'd always be working. I'm from Chicago, and my parents and everybody that's from up that way, it's just like work. That's it. It's such a blue-collar city that it's infectious. That's why the music scene is so competitive up there, because it's like, man, you're going to go on stage in this city. You pretty much got to light yourself on fire for people to unfold their arms and start tapping their feet.
As you mentioned that, it makes me wonder, you talked about work and putting that all into your music. Which mm-hmm. piece do you feel most accurately represents you as an artist, and why?
Man, probably So with Sam Hudgens. I don't know, the lyrics don't really sum me up, but what went into the song was really fun. Sam played me that song. He played me the sketch, the beat. It was just a beat that he made on his laptop. And I loved it. I was like, hey, if you're not doing anything with this, I would like to write to it. And he said, nah, I'm kind of writing to it now. And so I said, fair enough. And maybe 2-3 years later, he came over to my house and he played me it again. He forgot that he played it to me the first time. So he played it for me again. And he said, I'm stuck on this thing. I cannot write to it. And I said, let me have a WAV file of it. I'll write to it tonight. And I wrote So. And at the beginning, you know, the demo of So is me just singing So over that beat. And Sam's not singing on it at all. When we recorded the actual song, we erased my first verse. And we had Sam sing my first verse. And Sam pretty much sings the first chorus. I'm doing the backup vocals on the first chorus. And then I do my verse. And then the second chorus is this bigger chorus where we're both singing the leads and we're both singing the backup vocals. We worked on that track for years, as opposed to some things that I've recorded in 30, 40 minutes and put a record out just how it sounded that day I did it. But So was this anthem. And you used the word anthem earlier when you did your introduction. And that's what it was. It was like our Michelangelo. You know, we have to make sure every edge of this recording is perfect before we release it. It was just this dense product, all these layers that are in that piece of work. And it's beautiful. I mean, I love that song so much. That's a song where people have never heard my music before, and they asked me to play them something, I play So. Because it's also, you know, it's a Mathian song, but it's also a collaboration. It's a very serious 50-50 collaboration with Sam Hudgens.
It's interesting because it also reflects your work ethos. So that's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. You mentioned earlier a couple of other songs that you wanted to share a story about. Love to hear that too.
Oh, yeah. So Pool was another collaboration on Calabasas. Clifford, this guy Clifford, who played drums for a band called White Denim, and now he sometimes tours with a band called the Heartless Bastards. I think they're in Texas. He was from Austin, but he's in Houston now. And he was a drummer, but he started sending me his production stuff that he was doing, which consisted of a drum track. In this case, it was Wurlitzer piano, bass, and a little guitar. And he just sent me this arrangement, and I was like, this is really cool. But he wanted me to write to it. So one day I went downstairs and I turned it on and I listened to the instrumental of it. I started recording piano over it. I did a little extra guitar stuff on it myself and then grabbed the pen, grabbed the spiral, and I started writing lyrics. And the first thing I said was shooting pool in a basement. I don't know why I said it. I just said shooting pool in a basement. And it made me think. It immediately transported me back to this time where I was shooting pool. I was not in a basement. I was actually on the roof of a place called Reggie's. I was by myself. I was at a bar and this guy comes up to me and he's like, hey, you want to shoot some pool with me? And I said, yeah, sure. So I grabbed a pool cue and I started playing this guy in pool and he seemed hyped up. And then halfway through the game, I was like, oh, he was on some serious adult drugs. And as the game progressed, he started getting more and more sort of aggressive and agitated. And after a while, I was like, this guy is going to possibly try and like start a fight. He might try to fight me. And I wasn't in the mood. So I was beating this guy pretty bad in pool. I'm not a great pool player, but every now and again, I'll get hot and I'll start like playing really well. And it was one of those nights. I made the decision to lose the game on purpose so that nothing crazy happened. And it was really interesting because after I lost the game, I went over and shook his hand and you could tell he was like, he was disappointed that he didn't get to unleash his aggression or something. He was kind of confused, actually. And so for some reason, the music that Clifford sent me made me think of this story. And so I wrote it into the song Pool. And I say, in the middle of the song, I say, if it ain't within, it's been written in. So if you're not acting out of your instincts and you're not following your heart, something will get written into the script for you. And you're just going to have to follow that. And so that was knowing the difference between I could definitely win this game of pool, but this guy might put someone in the hospital or freak out, get kicked out of the bar, cause a problem.
Trust your instincts.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to lose.
Well, the path to success is through the path of failure.
I failed on purpose.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. It goes back to what we said earlier around how music can take you back to a specific moment in time. And that one lyric took you there. And it brought about this incredible song. So that's incredible. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you, Nilesh.
One last question for you. If you had a piece of advice you could give our listeners on unlocking their true potential and lead a life without limits, what would it be?
I would say every song is a lottery ticket. No, I'm just kidding. That can't be what I said. I can't steal it.
What's been something that you've really took time to reflect on through your journey and thought, if I saw someone going through these same scenarios in life, this is how I would help them?
Oh, you have to continue on through the doubt. Yeah, you have to continue on through the doubt. The doubt won't always be there. So yeah, doubt is temporary is another way to put it.
I like that.
There, we arrived.
We have arrived. We
you got one out of me.
That's great, but it was a beautiful one. Look, Mathian,
thanks, man.
I want to thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me on. I had a good time.
Oh, awesome. Me too. And I've learned so much. Your music is truly a gift to the world. And thank you for sharing this with us. And thank you for opening up and being vulnerable in places too.
It's cool.
And a huge thanks to everyone listening to Limitless Lives. Don't forget to hit the follow button on your preferred podcast platform. Take care of yourselves and each other.